Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Poetry is no place for a heart that's a hole. I'm young and strong, but I feel old and tired. Overfired. No more fire, only desire for you, whether you are. For you, whether you are. Oh, you say my time here has been some sort of joke that I've been messing around, some sort of incubating period. But when I really come around, but I'm cracking up.
Tell a story about him beating your mother really, really badly in front of your grandmother and Granny Tweed. Like in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the children, needless to say, were all screaming. Don't you fucking start crying, he said this. She deserves everything she gets. Don't you, Margaret? Don't you deserve it? Now tell your children that you deserve this beating. My mum looked up and tried to smile. I deserved the beating, children. Don't worry, I deserved it. In front of your granny and granddad, there was no real safe place at all.
No.
That was in their house, obviously.
Yeah.
And why did he then, you know, from the sexual abuse, or was it all the same, why did he then begin to attack you about your weight? I mean, what we see before us is a very beautiful young woman. And obviously this was part of his hatefulness, but another very striking part of it was how he started to undermine you. Hey, fatso, you have another biscuit, you fucking fatso.
Oh yeah, he'd call me half a house, so he would. And, you know, if I come walking into the living room, he'd make stomping noises. And I've never been overweight. I can look back now and go, have I ever been overweight.
So there's not a pick on you.
And that's the one thing that he picked out on me. And, you know, my other sister, he called her stupid, constantly called
retarded,
her
retarded, you say, in the book. They said she was a retard.
Yeah.
But tell me this, Amanda. I mean, tell me a bit about the, you know, this onslaught. How regular, how constant it was about your weight?
Because I want to ask you that. Every day.
And so give me an example. You're sitting here.
It would have been if I had walked, like really, if I had walked in, and sometimes I would have stood up against the hearth, you know, just to warm myself as I come in, and he would have been sitting, and, you know, the TV was on one side of the room, his chair was in the other, and, you know, I was leaning against the mantelpiece in the other, and I'd like, where did the TV go? It's disappeared, do you know, or he would just pass remark, I'd be like, say something like, have you put on weight?
Yeah.
Do you know, there was just, it was always something small that might not have looked too bad to other people, but there was always something small. Do you know what it was? Oh, look, here comes half a house.
Yeah. Mm. And then around that time, of course, he became a total hero because he got his first cap for Ireland, and there he was all of a sudden, an Irish international. Everybody in awe of him. Oh, your dad's brilliant, you know.
Yeah.
And, but the it wasn't just calling you fat and all. Perhaps you would just tell us what the consequences of that were for you, because it wasn't simply him constantly insulting you and, you know, this hateful, constant attack on this child about her weight, but it had very, very serious consequences for you.
Well, yeah, I stopped eating. So what did I, like, I would go into school and I would take my dinner money, but I would buy myself a drink and I would sit with the drink, and that's, and then I would start making excuses in the house as to why I wasn't eating dinner in the house in the evening. And it led to a very unhealthy relationship with food that I have only just within the past couple of years tried, you know, managed to overcome. And that's been with the help of my personal trainer that, you know, I've been able to do that, that he has helped me rethink how I see food. I had always then, you know, used it as a coping mechanism, so that whenever, you know, times were really, really tough for me, I would stop eating and I would withhold food. And that was a way for me to try and control what was going on, you know. So when there was chaos around me, because I had that autonomy removed from me whenever I was a child, I had no control over my body when I was a child. So when I started to get, you know, become a bit older, then when there was chaos all around me, I would control what I could put into my body, because I didn't have that control when I was younger.
Give us a for instance of your nutrition during the course of a week at that time.
At that time, during the course of a week, I maybe would have eaten two dinners in the whole week.
In 7 days?
Yeah.
Chewed a lot of chewing gum?
A lot of chewing gum, yes, I did. Eat an awful lot of chewing gum. There was one time I remember that I had gone 2 weeks without eating a bite, and I had gone out with my friends as usual and practically collapsed.
I mean, you must have been completely exhausted.
Yeah, it was. It was just completely exhausted. I was just done.
And your skin and bones, basically, eventually.
I felt that I thought that I had the flu. I just thought, oh, I'm taken sick, you know, need to get home, because my body ached. I was shivering.
It's a funny thing. Like, I'm friendly with some of the hunger strikers. And one of the things they said, I mean, Raven McCartney in particular said he was a hunger strike for about 60 days. That's right. And I said to him, like, you got used to not eating? He says, oh, no, no. He says, you're ravenous every minute of the day. Ravenous. Mm-hmm. Every minute. If anything, it got worse. So, look, how did you, was it a sort of a, because I'm conscious that later on you started to self-harm, with a knife across your wrist, etc. Was it like that? Explain the thing about control. It's a fascinating.
Yeah, I could convince myself that I wasn't hungry. Do you know, I would convince myself that the pains that I was having in my stomach were because I was ill and not because I was hungry. I would convince myself that, you know, the grumbling was because there was some other issue there. Do you know, it was a psychological battle for me, you know, in terms of the food and going hungry. But the withholding food, you know, even after that phase then, but as I got older, the withholding food, it was something that just came so easy to me. And I would convince myself then that if I ate anything, I would actually be sick. And I can remember sitting with my mum and her, like, you really need to eat something. And she set toast down in front of me. And it must have taken me about an hour to eat half a slice of toast. Like, I had chewed and chewed and chewed that much that I had forgotten how to swallow. And I ended up just spitting it out. And, you know, it's just that complete psychological battle, and I was so determined to control what was happening to my body because I wasn't able to control that as a child.
What age were you at that stage?
At that stage, I was an adult.
Mm-hmm.
I was, like, you know, over 18.
It was like a form of, was it like sort of a silent, very personal protest, the life that you were being forced to lead?
I don't know if it was that or if it was just a way of me trying to gain some sort of control of myself.
But I mean, my understanding from the writing is that that started because of the constant berating about your weight.
Yeah.
And in one sense, it illustrates the absolute power that he had over you.
Yeah.
I mean, did you say to yourself somewhere deep down, well, I'm going to show him that I'm not fat. I'm going to show him that I'm...
No, I wanted him to leave me alone. I thought if I wasn't fat or if I didn't look fat, then he would stop commenting at all. He would say nothing to me. I just wanted him to leave me alone. That's all.
Yeah.
All that was.
And here's a guy at that stage then, when you're, I suppose your anorexia is burgeoning and getting worse and worse and you're becoming very ill, who's getting phone calls from Dr. Ian Paisley, who's you know, getting to the stage where he's thinking about forming his own political party because the DUP is not extreme enough. Fuck. Ulster says no to the DUP. Fucking softies. And another, I suppose, a huge milestone in the book. And again, one of the most frightening things about it, you know, and for anybody out there who's listening, who's in a situation like this, you know, go and tell someone, go and tell a safe person. You know, we'll ask you to speak about that, Amanda. But one of the extraordinary things about all of this was that even though all of you were being abused, apart from your knowledge that your mum was being beaten constantly because he was doing that very openly, you had no idea that the other girls were being abused. They had no idea that you were being abused. And when you told your mum, in fact, it was that your dad was beating your mum very badly and you jumped on his back, you'd have said, I'm not taking this anymore.
Yeah.
And all the size of you, oh my God. Like, honestly, you're not, you, come on.
To be fair, I do still laugh about that.
Come on, come on. You're not built for.
No, definitely not.
He didn't even
not.
Use the baseball bat.
No.
He should have used the baseball bat.
I should have went for the knees. If they'd have taught me how to rugby tackle, it would have been fine.
I'm not sure he would even have felt you.
Probably not.
But you really jumped on us. Tell us about that incident.
Well, my mum came flying through the living room. I was sitting on the sofa, so my mum came flying through. And then he came after. And I was just like, I just launched myself up off the sofa onto his back to try and protect my mum. And he just flung me like a rag doll across the floor, and I landed in a heap in front of the TV. But yeah, it was. I have to say, I do laugh at that. All the size of me jumping in this big beast's back.
But that was what switched. That's what flicked the switch for your mother. It was all very well her being beaten.
Yeah. Whenever he turned on me, that was it. Yeah.
And that was the first phone call to the refuge, to the police.
Yeah.
And tell us what happened there and how your mother went back.
Yeah, I have to say I was a bit disappointed that she had gone back. I thought that whenever she was out at the refuge that that would be it. I had no understanding, you know, at my age of, like, I was 17 at that time. I had no understanding, you know, of how enmeshed you find yourself in these situations. And I just thought that when she was out, that would be it. You know, once she's seen that life could be different, that there was a break there away and she would have peace, that would be it, that it would be fine and we could set up our own life elsewhere. Mm. But, you know, I didn't understand the whole hoovering concept, you know.
What's that?
It's that whenever, like, he had contact then with my mum because my mum started to fear that the kids would be missing him. And so there was contact there over the phone initially, and he would start then telling her that he loved her so much and he misses her so much and he can't live without her, and he would go and get help and he would never hit her again and he just needs her to come back again, and just this whole sad sob story about how he can't live and survive without her.
Is that when he said he'd get anger management course? Yeah. But then said he couldn't be seen going to anger management.
Yeah, because, you know, how that would look for his career.
Yeah. Because, you know, you're going to be calling the Catholic priest a paedophile in front of the TV cameras, you know. You don't want to be lowering your reputation in the eyes of right-thinking people by going to anger management classes.
Yeah.
But it was the first time in the book that I relaxed. I thought, oh, my God, a bit of sanctuary for these children. Like, for this woman.
Time in my life I relaxed as well. Right. You know, I was yes, this is us. We're finally free. And that's what I thought. But
it's a brilliant description of it. I mean, it's a, you know, in order to make sure nobody followed us back there, I stayed at the refuge all the time. I didn't even go to college. This is you. I'm going to read this passage because it's where you think, oh my God, sanctuary. I took on responsibility in the refuge with pride and determination to do a great job. I hoovered and cleaned common areas often when they didn't even need them. And I helped the other mothers with their children and babysat while they went into town to get groceries in peace. We were all in one boat. It was my very first experience of camaraderie. I have never forgotten how much I thrived in the company of those women. And then one day, my mother said, I just wonder, are they missing their daddy? I swear my heart stopped and the knife I was using fell out of my hand.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to scream, no water.
And your face, even as Joe reads that now, is like, you almost feel like you can remember it vividly, the feeling you had.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a brilliant, you talk about your Davy, I won't say anything other than just Davy Tweed. You say that the first thing was that she then let the kids speak to him on the phone. Once my mum let the girls call Davy on the phone, he would spew his apologies and promises down it into my mother's ear. I'd hear him, a stream of non-stop word salad from his mouth. It was a type of brainwashing. He was almost hypnotizing her when he did that. She became so placid and malleable when he spoke like that. And I thought that was maybe the most frightening concept of all, because it hadn't occurred to me to look at it that way, that idea of hypnosis. Like of almost a superpower of, you know,
but maybe you is, could talk. Yeah, it is. Whenever somebody has been like that for you, it is like mind control, and they know exactly how to work you. Exactly how to work you. They know exactly what they need to say because they have had years of practice with their cycles of abuse and apologies and pulling you back in again and, you know, then pushing the boundaries a wee bit harder. You know, they have years of those cycles repeating, so they know exactly what to say to you. So it is like you are under some form of mind control. You know, as someone who is sitting on the outside watching it happen, do you know, I was like, why? You know, you've escaped. You got away from him. You know, if you go back, he could hit you again. But he just filled her head with all these promises and played on her own guilt as well.
What is it? I mean, I've often thought about that, you know, because I've known abused women. And this depressing merry-go-round of, but he really loves me, you know. I know that he has beaten me badly and he has fractured me and that he has sexually assaulted me, but he really loves me. What is it in a person that makes him go back to that terror, that makes him think that, Is it that they think the man can be saved? What is it?
Yeah, well, there's an element of that. It's like an addiction.
Mm.
Do you know, they create this need. So they do. They create this need. They create this idea that you need them. And, do you know, they will manage you in such a way that you actually believe it. Do you know, you need them for their money.
What did Davy Tweed offer your mum? What did he offer her?
Security. Financial stability, a home. Do you know, it might have been, and you know, like,
did she like the fact he was a rugby international?
No, she wasn't any of that. Whenever she met him, you know, he wasn't any of that. You know, it was the family, that stability, that fear as well that she would lose her children because he would take her to court and take them off her, you know, or take them in the other way. Yeah.
And it's the thing you say there, the addiction, like that is the thing. It is like that sense that you can't live without this.
Yes, and you feel like you can't live without this person. Plus, they do give you those wee glimmers of being a nice guy. And so whenever they've done something wrong, that nice guy comes back out again. Yeah. And so you cling on to that.
Yeah,
you cling on to that nice guy, and you want to do, you adjust your behaviour to try and appease him, to bring that nice guy out. So and that is part of the process along the way. So the nice guy appears in the beginning, and then nice guy turns bad because of something you've done wrong. So you adjust your behaviors, you adjust the way you dress, you adjust who you speak to, you adjust where you go, you adjust whether you wear makeup, how you do your hair, everything. You keep adjusting yourself to try and bring this nice guy back out again.
You think you can still get back to that kind of garden, you know, that like first first glimpse of that.
Don't speak to the other man. I mean, the episode you described, you know, where he beats her very badly because she speaks to another man outside.
She hadn't even spoken to him. He was walking his dog.
Aye.
My mum didn't even notice that he was there.
And he just said, "How you doing?" as he walked past.
Yeah, he just said hello, whatever. Mm. But my mum didn't even, you know, my mum was having fun on the bikes with his sister, you know, and the two of them were just having a crack.
She was with
crack.
His sister.
Yeah. And this man was walking his dog around, you know, the street. And like, my mum didn't even acknowledge him. And because Davy came up the avenue and seen him, she got a hammer and just because he was there.
I mean, and then I suppose another thing was that, and because we can't know without hearing from your mum, but another thing was, you see, that this constant, I suppose there was this constant high emotion and then assaults and attacks, and then high emotion and romance and then assaults and attacks, because there were constantly babies being born.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in your description, like, just before the time you left for England, you know, just before I went, my mother told me she was expecting again another child. My heart was on the floor. When she said it, the key to this prison we were in turned again, locking us in for longer. Our prison sentence was being extended. And then she's got a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got a husband who's earning, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
And then this dismal, dismal conveyor belt just...
Yeah. She had no confidence. My mum had no confidence, no self-confidence, no self-worth. Whatever she did have before she met him, he made sure and took away from her.
Just deliberately destroyed it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you say in that, when you talk about those, like there's a, you know... You would say, I had no idea about what true power was. I didn't know that Davy was actually a weakling.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when you sit here talking about him now, he doesn't seem like a, you know, you seem like the powerful person at this stage in your life.
Yeah.
And he was just a bully.
Well, he was. And, you know, on reflection and looking back now, you know, at that time I was a child, and I can sit now as an adult and I can go, it takes a really weak man.
Yeah.
To abuse his wife, his partner, and the children that were in his care in the way that he did, all just to try and gain some sort of control.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, it's like, how pathetic
were
you that's what you had to do in order to try and feel as if you had some sort of power or control, or as if you were someone?
It's sort of about that age, 16, 17, the feeling that comes out of the book is that you stopped actually being afraid of him. Or is that putting it too highly?
Yeah, that would put it too highly. I was still afraid of him, but probably, you know, I was going through a whole phase of not actually caring that much about myself or what happened.
Because you started to stand your ground. I mean, the overwhelming nature of it. I mean, this bastard was like a fucking evil octopus or something, you know. It was fucking tentacles coming around everywhere you were. Like, whenever I was really, you know, moved by your description of, but it was like a fuck you to him as well, when you describe in the book that once you eventually had gone to the police because he'd been acquitted of sexual abuse charges against other children, mainly because it seems his timesheets at work had been doctored so that they could say, call a witness to say, well, he couldn't have been because he was at work. Here's his timesheets, and I've signed off on his timesheets.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was a scary indication of the influence and power that he had, because everybody obviously knew at that stage what was going on.
Yeah.
You know. But once you had reported it to the police, every day when you were coming out from your work, he was there watching you. And I just wanted to read this passage because I felt that it was a moment where things changed, where you said, fuck you, you will not dominate me any longer. This is fucking over, brother. I know you didn't actually write those words, but you know, it's obvious. Sort of, you'd be far too. You'd be
put
far.
Words in my mouth.
You'd be far too polite. You'd be far too polite to do that. Davy was stalking me and harassing me every day, and I felt this immense regression to fear, which overrode my ability to think straight. One day, I noticed him standing across the road. His head was down, and he was staring at me from under his eyebrows. I wanted him to feel how he was making me feel. So as I chatted there with my work colleagues, I made a joke and pointed at Davy. And of course they all looked over and every one of them was laughing. The joke wasn't about Davy, but it worked. He felt intimidated and walked off. He had lost his power in that moment and he knew it. I didn't really see him after that.
Mm-hmm. That was a good moment for me. That felt great. So it did. And it was a very spur of the moment thing. It wasn't planned. I didn't lie, you know, awake at night thinking about how I would get him back. It was a very spur of the moment thing that happened. And, you know, I was just standing, locking up as we did. And I did just tell a joke and just pointed as I gave the punchline. And they all looked round while they were laughing to see naturally what I was pointing at. And yeah, he put his head down. And, you know, the scene in The Simpsons where, you know, Homer goes back into the hedge. It was kind of like, do you know, this skulking back into the pub again. And, you know, that was it. And he could not look me. Anytime he seen me, he pretended that he didn't see me. He would turn his head the other way. And I can remember the next time that I actually physically bumped into him was in court. And, like, he was a couple of steps up. He was coming down steps while I was just, you know, going up them. So, you know, already there's a height difference, but he was two steps ahead of me as well. And he was approaching me as I was coming up. I wasn't paying attention to where I was going. I was just kind of like, you know, dandering up to the court. And he jumped out of his skin and sidestepped to get out of my way. And I just thought, well, there you go. It worked.
Why do you think that was, Amanda? You know, that after all of this terror and everything that he'd done, that the act of you pointing at him and laughing at him was your friends, or him certainly thinking that that's what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that it had that?
I think like for him
profound effect on
yeah,
him.
Yeah, because the balance of power had shifted. Do you know when he realised that?
I understand that, but explain that to me. That was it that he? I mean, you explain it to me.
I think that he was afraid then because he knew what he had done in me. And he knew that that's something that I could tell anybody. Obviously, I had told the police and there was that pending, but I don't think he really understood, you know, how much me standing in my truth would impact him. You know, and when he seen that, those people laughing at him, and that's just demonstration of how weak he actually was and how pathetic he actually was, that, you know, a couple of people laughing at him would shake him that much. You know, he realised that if she can get those couple of people in her circle to laugh at me, then what else can she do? And I think he really genuinely feared that, you know, that imbalance of power in his eyes. You know, he feared losing that kind of power because he wanted to create himself and thrived on people looking up to him and respecting him. But in that moment, he felt, well, then people are laughing at me, they don't respect me.
And then that was sort of, you know, in a way, the public facade being just stripped away. Like,
yeah.
You know, you're an abuser and you know it, and I'm not afraid of you anymore. Mm-hmm. And you better lawyer up, brother.
Yeah.
Which he did.
Well, he did, yeah. You have to, like.
And maybe you could.
I don't want to go into that situation without a lawyer, but.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, yeah. It meant that there was. I mean, it was war. Then you were not going to let this sit any longer. I mean, I suppose after that, it seems that you just felt, well, like this is because you had prevaricated about the police. You said, "I'm not sure." Do you remember? He's like, "Oh, I'm not sure about doing this. I'm not sure. About, you know, I'll report it, but I'm not sure about a trial. I'm not sure about."
Yeah.
But after that, it seems that you were all right. I'm going to take this guy.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra.
and UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Done, you know.
Yeah, well, it was a case of wanting to stop him from hurting other people.
Yeah.
Do you know, and it was on hearing other people come forward and, you know, when other people speak out, it was like, no, this man needs to be stopped. Even though he's out of our house, he still, you know, as far as I was aware, he was living with someone who had a child. And I was like, I can't, in good conscience, continue on without trying to stop him.
It was eight other girls, wasn't it, that he was abused?
Seven others. There was eight of us in total.
Oh, yes, yes, of course. And tell us a bit about, you see, even meeting him in court, you know, on the steps, that would never happen nowadays, you know, because the witness protection scheme means that you come in a completely different entrance. I mean, it used to be shocking in those days. You could be sitting outside court and where? Sitting outside court across from the accused.
Yeah.
You know, in those sorts of circumstances, very vulnerable women do that. But now, thankfully, all of that has changed. But maybe you could tell us a bit about the courtroom, the trial, you know. I mean, it's explained very vividly, and we're going to say again to the readers, like, this is a truly, we have had some world-renowned authors in here, and this book would stand with any book that we've read. I mean, it's quite a masterpiece. But maybe you could talk a bit about the trial. And
the trial was difficult. It was very challenging. You know, initially getting that letter in as well to call you as a witness. You know, I didn't understand that. I had nobody to tell me or walk me through the court process at that time. And I know things have changed slightly now. But I just didn't have a clue what was happening. And I didn't know. I was like, on the phone with the policeman going, do I need to get myself a solicitor? Do you know, do I need to engage with someone here? And he says, oh, don't worry about it. There's a crown solicitor, a crown barrister. You'll be fine. And I was like, right, okay, that's...
It's awful, like, you get...
But you didn't get anything then until the day of the... You know, that was it. Yeah. Like, we'll see, we'll all be together in court.
Yeah, you get a letter saying you're required to appear at, like, inside courts at, you know...
But there's nobody to... you know, hold your hand, if you like, which is what you need in that situation.
Yeah. When we arrived at court, we were taken off to a different room. We did have witness support. So we did, and we were taken off to a wee family room, and, you know, we were told that we could share the room with other people, you know, but for the most part, it would probably just be us in there, and there's a kitchen and there's a fridge, and come and go as you please, make yourself at home. There was no different ways in and out. There was only one way in and out of the court, and, you know, I could have met him at security, even going through security, coming into the court. You know, I didn't, but he came in the same way we did. You know, and you know what it's like going through security in a court. It can be quite slow, and
I don't even notice it anymore. He's used to it. He's going to the shop, you know, he's going to the school in the morning.
Yeah.
Hi, how you doing?
Yeah. But so being in that other room was great, but we met the first time I'd ever set eyes on the Crown Barrister was the morning, the very first morning that we were in there, and he had a very brief chat with us.
I know who he is because, you know, but a very, very, very experienced Crown Counsel and a very expert Crown Counsel who dealt with your case, you know, and he would be one of the most senior prosecuting counsel in the north.
Yeah.
But, you know, you always have a bit of a shiver when you read the defence cross-examination of you, you know,
mm-hmm.
the suggestion that you'd been dreaming. These were all.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, I understand that they have a job to do. Do you know, I get that. Yeah. That's fine. But it still felt very unfair that I was in there as a victim.
Yeah.
And I was being, you know, questioned as if I had done something wrong.
Hmm.
Do you know, I felt as if I was being interrogated. And I understand, yes, I was being interrogated, but it was as if I had done something wrong.
You say, I would have taken a physical beating any day over that verbal lashing.
Yeah.
You could have been dreaming this happened to you. That's not what I'm saying at all. I said, stop trying to put words in my mouth. The judge interrupted. Miss Brown, you will do well to answer the questions as they are put to you. The barrister changed tack. You were married, I was. The questions surprised me. But this marriage failed, is that right? We were not compatible in the end, I said. Do you blame Davy for that as well, he asked. I haven't considered who's to blame, I said. It was awful. Each night of the trial, I would lie awake running his questions over and over, asking myself if he was right to ask them. You know, I felt trapped in a cat-and-mouse conversation where what I was said was being spun into something I didn't mean. After my evidence was done, each time I went to the ladies' toilets to let that ball of tears out, I sat in the toilet and cried my eyes out into my hands as quietly as I could. Then I fixed my makeup, brushed my hair, and went back out for the next round. I'll give it to you, this kiddo, you can write. By Jesus, you can write.
And all that time you had a, you know, a simple mantra in your head, the truth is easy.
Yes.
You knew you had the truth.
That was the barrister had given that to me on the morning, and he had said, given to both of us, he sat down and he was explaining to us how difficult it was to achieve a guilty verdict in historical child abuse cases, and how our job was hard and their job was easy because they only had to cast an element of doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And his parting words were, the truth is easy. And I held on to that throughout that entire court case. And that, in fact, was going to be the title of the book.
Was it?
Yeah. And it wasn't until I finished my first draft and submitted it that I went, you know, the truth's not easy. I've lost a lot through standing in my truth. You know, and it has brought up a lot of, you know, yes, it has brought about a lot of healing as well, but I lost an awful lot by standing in my truth. You know, I left jobs so I could stand in my truth. Yeah. I lost my partner. I left home.
Because that was, and I didn't want to assume, but it was whenever you decided, okay, I'm going to do this, that it seemed that at that point in time then, that your marriage, that started to.
Yeah.
You know, and you paint the picture. It's very poignant, I have to say. But I'm not going to spoil this, but essentially what happened ultimately with the defence was that the way they approached it with this was sort of a revenge campaign, that you were involved in a revenge campaign against Davy Tweed. I don't think these are your memories at all. I think after Davy was accused 3 years ago, because he'd previously been acquitted of sex abuse, that someone else constantly insinuated that you had been abused and you've taken that up. I don't know what you mean. Why are you really saying these things about Mr. Tweed? You know they're untrue. You don't remember the details of any of the incidents you claim that have happened to you. I'm not a robot. I'm scared. I can't sleep at night. Wasn't it your mother who asked you to accuse David Tweed as a revenge for the beatings he gave her? Did she ask you to do this? I mean, it's brilliantly realised. And then, of course, the jury go out to consider their verdict.
Mm-hmm.
What were you feeling at that stage?
Do you know what? As I say, there was a point where I could see that his barrister believed me. And for me, that was my point of winning. I didn't really, you know, what came after that. I was not expecting a guilty verdict. I was expecting, fully expecting a not guilty verdict. But it was the wait. Do you know, it was, you're just sitting waiting and it's so painful. You know, waiting on that.
Was it? You know, what I often hear from clients, you know, people particularly who have suffered terrible traumas and deaths and all of that, that there's a release itself in saying it out loud in public. describing what has happened to you. You know, yeah. There's a sense of, there's a therapeutic element to that.
Yeah, absolutely. With writing the book and speaking my truths and revealing, you know, waving my right to anonymity has been cathartic. Do you know, it has allowed me to let go of stuff that, you know, that I was holding on to. Yeah. Do you know, and I do have and always have had quite a strong sense of justice. And, you know, I didn't think that if I maintained my anonymity and allowed him to be carried on as he was being, that it would have been just or fair for other victims, and not just his victims, but victims all over.
What's your life like now?
My life's it's good now. You know, it is. I've set up my own business. I've got my wee son. I've got a really good partner. I've got good friends around me, you know, and my family are brilliant as well. It's just... Yeah.
I have to say I smiled when you came breezing down the hallway because with Dion, because I didn't know what to expect, and, you know, I didn't know how you would be. But you're a ball of charisma, and you're not, you know, you're clearly not a shy person, and you've got a mischievous twinkle in your eye.
Well, definitely.
And it was really, in a way, a magnificent thing that you've done to be able to survive all of this, and to, not just that, but to write something that will be, I think, of immense value to other people who have suffered in the way that you have. And also, I think I have never seen, you know, even our conversation today, I don't know what you think of this, Dion, but I've never had it explained to me in a way that makes such a completely fucked up thing make perfect sense.
I've been told I'm good at that.
And I wanted to just end on that because, you know, you're in Dublin today and your son is with you, mm-hmm. and there's, you know, there's so much powerful stuff in the book. But one of the moments where I did, again, well up with emotion, but it was a kind of almost positive emotion, was when you were talking to your mother about your son. And you say to her, "I feel like I don't even care about him."
Yeah.
Just when he's been born. And your mother says, and it's just because of everything you've been through, it's so moving. And she says, "A wet nappy hasn't stayed on that child for so much as a minute. That's how much he is loved." And then she just says this thing, which is kind of like, love is doing.
Yes, yes, yeah. Because I was very caught up in the emotion, do you know, and why I didn't feel. Do you know the way people talk about this overwhelming sense of love that they feel whenever a child's born? I didn't feel that. So I felt that there was something wrong with me and maybe I didn't love him. So, do you know, it was in my mum saying that love is in doing. Do you know, there was a bit of a light bulb moment for me with her as well. Do you know, because my mum was never very, she wasn't tactile when we were younger. She didn't tell us very frequently that she loved us, but we somehow knew that we were loved. And it was in that doing, do you know, that she sacrificed so much for us as children that, you know, she showed her love.
Amanda, thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.